Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 18, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. Our topic for today is that we'll be discussing a new paradigm for the world with a report from the Pacific. And this is from my guest here in the studio live today, Mike Billington. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Mike is, you never know where you're going to see Mike. He's often here, but he is the Asia Desk Editor for Executive Intelligence Review for EIR Online. And I can say more about him in a minute. There's much to say because, but in particular, over the last, Mike, about 8 months or something, you've attended many of the world, of the international conferences for a new paradigm in Germany, in New York City, in Washington, near Washington, D.C., in fact, and a sister effort in the Philippines. And the that's of special interest to us right now. But before I turn things over for you to open the discussion of this dialogue, you personally, as well as in general, we're having internationally, I want to discuss certain developments of significance here in the United States, because it's funny, we, Mike, we scheduled you to be able to be here with us on the Pacific a few days ago, and after which time on Thursday, May 16, there was a special, a development of special potential. That is, in the U.S. Congress on the Senate side, a bill has been introduced for reinstating Glass-Steagall, which in effect, whatever its wording, is a companion to the one in the House of Representatives, which was introduced in January and now has some 63 signatories. That's House of Representatives H.R. 129 to reinstitute it. And the two initiating co-sponsors were Marcy Kaptur from Ohio, the longest-serving woman in the Congress, and Walter Jones from North Carolina. So what happened on May 16, which is the 80th anniversary of the introduction of Glass-Steagall in under President Roosevelt back in 1933, is the Iowa Senator Tom Harkin introduced S-985. And this just means that it's not in itself, although there's three cheers for that, because this has been an impasse, not having this bill in the Senate. But it just creates the preconditions, the circumstances to get Glass-Steagall reinstated. And it's pointed out to us, it was on Mr. LaRouche's Friday webcast last night, the 17th, that that the original Glass-Steagall bill was put into law within 30 days. Now, today that seems like a miracle, but then miracles are made. They don't just happen. And so this is a very important development. Let me just say the text of it, of this resolution, it's an actual bill, S-985, was not yet posted in the congressional system. But here's what its description is officially. The summary title is, and I'll quote, a bill to repeal certain provisions of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act and revive the separation between commercial banking and the securities business in the manner provided in the Banking Act of 1933, the so-called Glass-Steagall Act, and for other purposes. So there's no ambiguity, but just to underscore that it's there, the House and Senate come back this coming Monday and Tuesday, which is extremely important, everyone. It's not our topic today to discuss what a checklist of what everyone should do, but go for it next week is what to do. Because after that, there will be the Memorial Day recess of some length. Memorial Day is observed this year, the 26th and 27th of May. And we don't have any minute to lose in this situation of potential, which Mike can talk about how it's looked at around the world, especially in the Pacific, as a matter of hope. But we also have to understand the danger involved. The enemy to having grounds for economic development, that is sound banking, projects of necessity for infrastructure improvements on all continents of the world. This kind of future that we want to build has enemies, best called the British Empire, and they happen to be on the ropes, but it doesn't mean they aren't dangerous and can provoke warfare, chaos, economic harm, which is taking place. And so that's our situation. Great potential, great danger. And we're very glad that Senator Tom Harkin did introduce this. And now it's for it continues to be up to us, which it has been all along. Now, so let's turn towards what we want Mike to fill us in about. And I guess, Mike, if you want to, you can start anywhere. I want to tell people you've been associated with Mr. LaRouche for what? 40 years, 1972-ish?
42 years.
Yeah. Okay. And I will just tell people, people will be familiar with Mike Billington from his writings in EIR Online. You've seen him at different times on LPAC TV and other places. But Mike was targeted for punishment, for a threat, and actual jailing for his activity. He was given a combined federal and state sentence of 77 years, served at least 10 years in jail. Mike can correct me, but I want to point out that his book he wrote at the time, well, you were released in year 2000, I think, but was, let me just repeat what it is, Reflections of an American Political Prisoner, the Repression and Promise of the LaRouche Movement. So Mike can speak with a great deal of authority. That's not in question. And I'll mention some of the articles in most recent months. I'd like to remind people if you missed it at the time. But Mike, maybe you want to start with the view from elsewhere in the world of the necessity for Glass-Steagall, that there's no other way and there's no other venue but the United States to force this shift in order to give the opportunity to the world again.
Well, yeah, that's the point that that LaRouche has made over and over and over again, is that this is not going to come from anywhere else. It can't come from Europe. Those nations have lost their sovereignty with the Maastricht and the Euro. They have no national sovereignty. They can't act. They're impotent to act. They can do some good things here and there, but they have no power to change this global collapse into both economic deterioration, genocide, and probable warfare. But as most of your listeners know, the fact that we made this tremendous breakthrough with Senator Harkin getting this bill introduced into the Senate, and let me just mention that the Obama British Wall Street crowd were banking on being able to stop this in the Senate. It's out of their hands in the House. We now have, what, 63 co-sponsors and growing, Republicans, Democrats, mostly Democrats who are bucking the Obama administration, knowing full well that he's adamantly, violently opposed. But in the Senate, they thought they had the power through their leaders in the Senate, Harry Reid and so forth. So the fact that Harkin bucked this and unleashed what should be, if we do this right, if we don't mess it up, a rapid mobilization is entirely our work. Most of the people who are listening are people who are part of the national mobilization that we've done over the last months, bringing people to Washington for weeks of action over the last 2 weeks in somewhere between 20 and 30 states, going to the state houses, mobilizing, fighting there to get people to take personal responsibility for the fate of civilization, and getting letters from around the world. And these letters from around the world saying what you just said, that basically calling on the Congress to recognize that they, from whatever nation in Europe or in Asia or in Latin America, wherever, that they know that this is in America's hands, and that they, if they have the courage to act in the Congress to fight this through, they will have support from around the world, but that it's up to them. And this had a tremendous impact on the people in the Congress to recognize that the world is watching them, and they're going to be responsible if they fail, but they're also going to be doing good if they take responsibility, stand up against Wall Street, against Obama, against the British. So this is quite a a breakthrough. And of course, it didn't come out of nowhere. It came from our vast mobilization here and the conferences that you referenced. And I hadn't actually realized it until you mentioned it. I've been to all four of these conferences. Began last November when Helga, having been to one of these Dialogue of Civilizations conferences, which do some useful good, they get people together from around the world and they talk about why we have to avoid war and that why we need development. But they're also eclectic. They bring in people from all different fronts. Some of them are horrible people that they feel responsible to bring in because they represent banking institutions and come in and spout green nonsense and hysterical banking genocide policies at the same time. But this is democratic, you see. We have to allow the Nazis to come in and have their say. So that these talk shops, just at a time of great, great crisis like this, Helga realized that these go nowhere. And at the end of the event, people say, oh, we just talked some very nice things, and now we're all going to go home, and we'll come back next year and talk some very nice things. Well, there might not be a next year. And Helga's intent was, we must bring together people in important positions, people who've made something of themselves, and who recognize that LaRouche's ideas, the idea of Glass-Steagall with the creditary system and great infrastructure projects globally, that nothing short of that can stop this descent into a new dark age, into thermonuclear war, and bring them together to discuss that, not just to give their opinions or their views, but to get a serious discussion on how can we implement this policy globally, starting in the U.S., but as a universal policy for the human race. And the first, I won't go through the conferences, but we had two in Frankfurt, one in November and one just in April, and then one in Washington and one in New York. Extraordinary conferences. They're just the beginning. But the idea is that these people have to focus on the question of how do we change the United States. And I think it's worth mentioning how the enemy deals with that. The basic thrust from Wall Street and from the investment bankers and the oligarchy generally, the Venetian Empire, the British Empire, is to approach those like-minded people, be they in Russia or in Italy or in Japan or in China, and they say, yeah, that's very nice. We want infrastructure. We're all for development. We think development's a wonderful thing. However, the LaRouche movement isn't going to go anywhere. You're not going to get Glass-Steagall. They failed thus far, and they're going to continue to fail. And we have a lot of money. We have sovereign funds. We have printing presses. We can get the money. And if you really want infrastructure development, then, you know, we can help you out. Now, of course, they have nothing. They have a lot of paper and a lot of computer printouts that are absolutely worthless as we watch the world descend into a hyperinflationary collapse where they're printing $1 trillion a year, actually $3 or $4 trillion a year between the US and Europe, all of which is going to bail out this absolutely corrupt, bankrupt banking system, the investment bankers, the derivative bubble, not a penny of which is going into any real physical economy. And the idea of using money as a bribe, I mean, LaRouche has always emphasized, money is nothing, it's paper, it has no value. Value is not money. But especially at a time like this, not only does it have no value, but it's not even worth toilet paper, you know. It's worthless, literally, because we're looking at the complete collapse of the physical economy while they're printing money wildly. Not a penny of which is going to keep people alive or to build anything that could produce anything with which we could deal with the long-term issues of debt and credit. So that's what these conferences have. They've, I think, had a significant input along with the work done by the American population in this mobilization. And there's another myth, which is the main subject today, is the question of what's going on in Asia and the Pacific. Part of the myth presented by the British Empire is, yes, America's collapsing, yes, Europe's in a terrible crisis, but Asia's doing great. China's making lots of money. Japan, well, they've got some problems, but Korea's doing good. Asia's on a roll. And the world has shifted to Asia, and we don't really have to worry about a collapse in the West because enough money is being generated in Asia that it's going to bail out us global financial institutions, and we'll somehow muddle through. Well, this is obviously a concocted lie, and I think we need to look at that a little bit and think about what does have to be done in Asia.
Right. So. On the lying department, well, first let's stick to the danger, if you don't mind. I one thing about, or if you want to continue on the economics, it goes together. But we've had this presentation, we've had this promotion of the idea, well, in the United States, well, we'll just reorient to Asia, and including some of this idea that it's going to be, it's where it's at, there are all these people, so we'll have a Trans-Pacific Partnership and still more free trade. We'll have the Asia pivot. We remember when President Obama went to Australia, and we'll have all this. It's reorienting, it's in line with the myth you're just describing.
Right.
And it's strategically very dangerous, and there's a new element, maybe you could describe it better, for even the British saying, well, since the United States is going to be reorienting to the Asia pivot, we'll move into the completely disintegrating so-called Mideast with more of our forces. This is an insane strategic situation.
All right, what's the reality in China? Yes, they've done a lot of good things, and they're still committed to the idea of development and progress. There's no question.
Yeah, space. Nuclear.
Yes, they're full steam ahead.
Agriculture, research, you could mention.
And these are all very good things. But the way in which this whole situation developed was that the Anglo Wall Street crowd decided that they could no longer loot the United States adequately and decided to move their production into cheap labor situations in China. The Chinese made the decision, a wrong decision, by the way, to accept this mass redeployment of industry and manufacturing into China without building the kind of basic infrastructure and education and facilities for their population overall. And it only worked because millions, and I mean millions of people, were basically herded out of the countryside into these production zones along the coast, where they worked for virtually nothing, and in fact were recycled in and out. When they just got worn out, they'd be dropped and go back home and live on the farm again, living in a situation not terribly different from many, many centuries ago. And somebody else would come in and replace them. So this was a process that earned a lot of money, some of which was put to good purposes. So it's not to deny that, but it was entirely dependent on cheap labor and on exports. And what are we looking at now? The absolute collapse of the markets that this production was oriented towards. And as this collapse unfolds in the United States and Europe, as it is already in Europe, we're looking at a situation in China in which the vast gap between the big handful, by the way, of billionaires, a lot of people who have been made very, very rich, and the vast majority of their 1.3 billion people who still live in very primitive, impoverished positions in the countryside. And as this bubble, and it is a production bubble, it blows, as it's beginning to do now, we're looking at a potential social catastrophe. And the Chinese are aware of this. The new government, which is as yet untested, of Xi Jinping, has, like the last government under Hu Jintao, said our biggest problem is this vast gap between the poor and the rich. Hu Jintao was not able to deal with it. Can Xi Jinping? It's not clear. There's a lot that could be said, but I don't think this is the place to discuss that. But the question there is, how do you avoid what in fact is a pending mass disaster and catastrophe? That's the real issue for China, not can they sustain the collapse of the Western banking system? And then you have similar situations which are worth going through in Japan and in Korea. But I think, let me shift a little bit and say, how are we going to deal with Asia? Because there's no question but that the tradition that the Glass-Steagall bill represents, which is not just a particular piece of legislation, it's actually an entire process. It's a concept. It's a concept that goes back to the American system idea, what Lynn calls the creditary system. And this tradition has a very, very deep history in Asia, and one which is still alive, although constantly at battle with British and imperial types of influences. I think the China one you've probably discussed in this show many, many, many times, which is that of Sun Yat-sen, who was the founder of the Chinese Republic in 1911, and who was educated in Hawaii by Americans who taught him Alexander Hamilton, taught him the principles that that Benjamin Franklin, but also Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, Henry Carey, I guess.
And Henry Carey's ideas, Friedrich List's ideas. This was the bedrock. His three principles of the people came from the Lincoln government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And it was this concept that he unleashed through his great personal leadership. And I think these issues demonstrate the crucial nature of individual leadership, of small numbers of people who decide that they recognize that history is driven by the power of ideas, not by masses, not by popular opinion. In fact, it's usually brought about in an all-out war against popular opinion to try to educate people to true principles, universal principles, rather than to how they feel about things. So this is a tradition which is returning in China since the disaster of the Cultural Revolution, a revolution which was explicitly brought about by the British intentionally, starting way back in the 1920s when Bertrand Russell went to China and unleashed his campaign against Confucianism, against the family, against the Chinese traditions, and in favor of what became the left or worst side of the communist movement, the kind of anarchist, anti-intellectual, peasant-based thinking, which when, in fact, again, a long story I won't go into, but when that sort of seized power in China in the 1960s, you had this decade of true dark age, the so-called Cultural Revolution, which was the realization of the British dream for China destroying itself. And they recovered from that, and they recovered in a way by looking back towards their own positive traditions, the Confucian tradition, but also opening up to the better ideas in the West. Unfortunately, some of those opening up to the West included opening up to the British free market, free trade, invisible hand kind of thinking, which led to these export zones and to the attempt to make quick bucks without doing the long, hard work like you saw actually in the United States in its first century to build up the nation and build up the yeoman farmers. And instead, they simply utilize the cheap labor of the peasantry to make money through these development zones.
Yeah, but, let me throw one thing in here. Not to it's something so basic as food. We have quite a critical situation. It's not because one steps back and demonizing China. They have a lot of eaters and they're eating up the world's food. That's a stupid idea. That's been put out there for 20 years by World Watch, which was a concoction to do such stupid, put out such stupid ideas. But similarly, a certain amount of the agriculture in general has suffered in the way you're describing about accommodation to the world free markets, in the sense that a great deal of orchard and a certain kind of higher value food is exported from China in order to have the revenue, and in turn, which is now being used to purchase the bulk soybeans, corn, and even rice when necessary. So everything is becoming marginalized on the line, just as what you're describing, that it's very dangerous, and it's an immediate problem. It isn't some long distance in the future.
Yeah, the report that you put in the EIR this week, and I encourage listeners here to open up the Executive Intelligence Review online this week. The cover story is a presentation given by Robert Ziegler, who's the head of the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, one of the institutions launched by Norman Borlaug. Which there's several of these around the world focused on different grains, different foodstuffs.
Yeah, potatoes.
Animals, yeah. But the one on rice is in the Philippines, and Bob Ziegler, who's a Pennsylvania farmer, grew up not far from Marsha Baker here, is a terrific guy. And the article is on the scientific potential of transforming food and rice production in particular. But he, in several of his presentations, has made the point that while people talk about how Asia is doing so great, the percentage of the population suffering from malnutrition and even stunting in Asia is actually worse than the percentage in Africa, which is an amazing figure, because of course there's many more people, but it's not just a larger number of people, but even the percentages. So people are still living in many parts of Asia in an extremely backward kind of condition. And if we don't make those breakthroughs in scientific research of the sort that were developed through the Green Revolution by Borlaug and his associates in the 1960s and 70s, then we're facing exactly what we're looking at today: vast food shortages and vast starvation on a mass scale, precisely what the British Empire desires.
Yeah, and those, you mentioned the initial developments, 1960s and 70s. It was 1974 where India became self-sufficient in basic grains, which it hadn't been, and under the British, including under Churchill in 43, but in the 1800s, they had famine under the British policy. So, but these breakthroughs, and the one you described, that's in the, by the way, May 17th EIR online, and looked at the week before, May 10th EIR online, has a review of the world rice situation by Dr. Ziegler. But these breakthroughs in the 60s and 50s, 60s and 70s were still presuming that we would be developing ever-expanding water supply, ever-expanding fertilizer development, ever-expanding land resources development. And this is exactly what, to fast forward, was in, you mentioned Sun Yat-sen, that was the view embodied in him, that was a view embodied in the American system, and that's what Glass-Steagall is a gateway for, to have credit at the service of building a future like this.
Let me switch to this conference we had in the Philippines, because it's on this line.
Was April, I think, you want to describe,
yeah.
And it's in the, please.
Yeah, I did an article on that that's in the EIR from
probably May 10th.
May 10th, I
yeah.
believe,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which is online. Now, this is the one movement that exists in Asia, which is explicitly a LaRouche, Glass-Steagall, American system movement. And this has been built over many, many years through the leadership of Butch Valdez, our close friend in the Philippines, who's head of the Philippine LaRouche Society, and the founder of the movement he calls Save the Nation. The principles there, you'll see, reflect precisely this kind of international perspective. The first is scientific food production. The Philippines was a nation which, under Spanish colonial boot for hundreds of years, and then when the U.S. Liberated the Philippines from Spanish rule, the unfortunate reality was that the Theodore Roosevelt mentality took over, and the country was not in fact liberated, but was turned into what was America's colony. and was the beginning of this Anglification of the United States. There were some good sides to that. The MacArthur family, Douglas MacArthur's father, was one of the key people bringing the Philippines forward during that era. And of course, Douglas MacArthur himself defended the Philippines from the Japanese invasion and came back and recovered it. But the nation, let me put it this way. I just came back from Asia, and I spent several days in Korea and did several meetings and conferences in Korea. First time I've seen Korea. It's an incredible city. Seoul is an incredible city. I didn't see the whole country, but I think the entire country is pretty incredible. And then I flew from Korea to Manila for this conference, for the Save the Nation conference, committed to scientific food, to nuclear power. I didn't mention the 3 points, the nuclear power, and a moratorium on the debt in collaboration with this international fight for Glass-Steagall. But in flying from Seoul to Manila, the contrast was just breathtaking and heartbreaking, in fact, because in the 1970s, Seoul and Korea were devastated from the Korean War, one of the poorest countries in the world. The Philippines was, unfortunately, one of the poorest countries. Well, actually, it was far ahead of Korea at that time, and people in Korea envied the Philippines, which had the potential, great potential for development, but was still a very poor agricultural country. After having been through equally devastation from the Second World War, a lot of the country was destroyed under the Japanese occupation and the battle to revive it. And you had two leaders who were very good friends, Park Chung-hee in Korea and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, who were close friends, admired each other, had similar goals. They wanted to build nuclear power plants. In fact, they began building nuclear power plants, identical Westinghouse nuclear power plants, at the same time. They wanted to industrialize and modernize their agriculture. They wanted to be independent, sovereign in their financial affairs, although they both very much admired the good that America could do to develop them. They were increasingly aware that what they were getting from the United States was a British-style colonial policy holding them back, and they therefore took strong leadership and began this process of building what in fact would become a modern industrial nation. And in Korea, it worked. It happened.
To go through some of that.
Well, it's an extraordinary development, very much like the American system, in that he used the government to direct credit. And the idea of directing credit is like what Lynn talks about when he says the American system is a creditary system, that the government uses its power to make sure that the credit of the nation, not just money, but that the nation's credit, which uses money in some cases, but directs development for the betterment of the nation, what we call in America the general welfare of the population. And in doing so, you foster leading industrial companies, scientific development, scientific agriculture, infrastructure, nuclear power, water power, roads, rail, and so forth. And this is exactly what was done in Korea. And it began to be done in the Philippines. And then the beginning of the neocon movement in the United States, George Shultz and his associates during the Nixon years and later in the Reagan years, Shultz orchestrated, he and Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy as Secretary of State, orchestrated a coup in the Philippines, which most Americans and many Filipinos still think was a people's power revolt by the people of the Philippines against the dictator Marcos. That's increasingly recognized in the Philippines as a total scam, that in fact what happened was a foreign military-directed coup whose purpose was to stop that nuclear power plant, and it was shut down literally the week it was ready to be turned on, and it still sits there as a deserted scarecrow, a horrible symbol of how the nation was destroyed. never produced 1 watt of electricity, even though it was ready to go, and even though the Philippines was forced to pay every penny of its construction cost. Their agriculture, which under Marcos they had become self-sufficient in rice for the first time, collaborated with the great Chinese scientist Yun Shu Ping, is that his name? Who was one of the Green Revolution people, brought the IRRI, this International Rice Research Institute, into the Philippines, built infrastructure, built railroads. All of this was completely and utterly scrapped, and has not any of it has all these years, since 1986 when he was thrown out, nothing has been done. So it's heartbreaking. The city is impoverished. There's kids running around the street barefoot, pleading for a penny. Vast unemployment. Everything's old. Seoul, everything is new. Everything is developed. It's just a very ugly, a contrast which just makes you really weep for what happened to the Philippines, and gives hopefully the Philippine people a sense of what can be accomplished if they succeed in this Save the Nation movement. And I'll just mention on that, the conference that Butch pulled together was really quite extraordinary, because what happened was that he had built this movement in collaboration with several other institutions, engineers, nurses, teachers, institutions in the country. And when he called this conference, organized largely through his weekly radio show, which we speak on often from here in Washington, but he organized it through his radio show over several years' time, decided it was time to hold the first national conference. And what happened was that one after another, institutions from all over Manila and around the country came forward to say, I'm here representing this organization or that organization, military groups, civil workers, farmers, and so forth, that we're here because we believe in what you're doing, what Butch Valdez and the Save the Nation movement and the LaRouche movement are doing. So it represents, I think, a real hope that something can be accomplished there.
Well, people should know, if you, Mike, described this directed credit in Korea, developing South Korea, the Korea model, in the EIR this year. It's the February 15th EIR. And do you want to say something, a few particulars about some the Mr. Park and so forth?
Well, the two main parts of his program were the heavy, heavy and chemical industry focus, much of what we now know as the Chaebol of Korea, Hyundai, Samsung, the very famous Daewoo. These names were companies that were not just picked out of the blue and said, okay, we're going to give you all the money. It was competition. They had to prove. He would direct some credit into these companies with the idea of developing a heavy industry in steel, chemicals, and so forth, including a military aspect. And those that made it, who were actually making themselves competitive on a global scale, and they had to be competitive on a global scale through this kind of directed credit. If they did, they got more credit. If they didn't, they got cut off. And interestingly, he did the same thing in the countryside. This is the famous Saemul Undong program, where he went into all the villages brought in several bags of cement, some steel rod, and some machinery, and some advisors, and said, okay, here you go. We're going to give you this, and you're going to use it to start building up your irrigation systems, your roads, your buildings. Let's see what you can do. We'll be back in a year. And they came back in a year. And if those towns who use this to build their city through this kind of self-help with direction and with support were able to achieve something, would get a little more the next time around. Those that didn't. And he also used the electrification process, not to deny electrification to anybody, but he was electrifying the entire country. And he said, why not give the electricity to those villages first who are going to use it? Or as he said, not just so that there's going to be light at night so people can sit around drinking and gambling and
play cards and do worthless activity.
Yeah, worthless activity. So, it was a it was a hard-nosed approach that said, we are a destitute, backward, poor country. It's our people who have to develop themselves as more than just grunts, more than just workers. They have to be creative. They have to master the science behind industrialization and the science behind agriculture, and they have to themselves become engineers and scientific thinkers. And that's the way we can, in fact, change our country into a modern industrial country. And it is, you know, as you know, Korea is now not only producing nuclear power plants, I think they have 20 functioning in the country, and they're selling them. They're building them and selling them to the UAE, and they have bids in for other. So they're exporting nuclear power. This is a real model for the developing world.
And of course, the British Outlook called him, I think, a tyrant, dictatorial.
Yes, terrible. Same with Marcos. Marcos was called a horrible dictator and a tyrant. Any strong leadership, it was called dictatorial and tyrannical, authoritarian, as they often labeled LaRouche, you know, from this British imperial targeting of anybody who wants to be creative, who's denounced as not going along to get along, of not appreciating popular opinion. Why, you're going against popular opinion, you must be an authoritarian. This kind of operation. This is imperialism. This is the way it's always, always worked. And the unfortunate reality is that the United States, increasingly after the killing of Kennedy, who, by the way, was a very strong supporter of Park Chung-hee, and he was a very strong supporter. Well, many things. He was refusing to go to send American troops into Vietnam. And as soon as he was killed by the British, then you began to see the undermining of the support for people like Park Chung-hee and for Marcos, and of course the launching of this hideous war in Vietnam, which the United States has never recovered.
Well, on the question of war and direct intervention, then you got this whole. I mentioned before about the Asia pivot, that there should be a militaristic buildup and threat against development shift in China, against, what do you want to say about this in particular, the playing up or not of North Korea,
right,
constantly making threat situations and playing up strife?
Right, this comes to the issue of Japan.
Okay.
It was interesting, while I was in Korea, nobody in Korea seemed to care a bit about what was going on in North Korea. In fact, the only questions I got were, why are the Western press and government so hysterical about these empty threats coming from the North? I mean,
okay,
we know they don't mean anything. It just means that it's the spring and the people are hungry and they're trying to rally around national causes to keep the population from revolting, which is what happens every year in North Korea. I mean, there is a problem.
Spring
in North
before
Korea,
the harvest comes in.
But that's their provocations. Were met by Obama with a series of unbelievable provocations, sending nuclear-armed B-52s, fighter jets, anti-ballistic missile systems, new ABM systems in Guam, trying to set up a new X-band radar and an anti-ballistic missile system, a second one in Japan and a new one in the Philippines, and on and on. This was a massive show of nuclear force on China's border. And no one could miss, and certainly the Chinese did not miss, that this massive overkill had nothing to do with North Korea. Just as the Russians recognize that the anti-ballistic missile systems in Europe, which they claim are protecting against Iran, who doesn't have missiles that can even reach there, is actually targeting Russia. This is the threat that the British are standing up, basically threatening to confront Russia and China with thermonuclear war if they don't give in to the new colonialism, to the regime change, as we've seen already in Iraq and Libya, and they're trying to do in Syria, and they might well try to do in North Korea. And if you wonder why the North Koreans don't want to give up their nuclear weapons, well, they saw what happened in Libya and Iraq when they gave up their nuclear weapons programs. So they are simply not taking the bait this time. And if we're going to have a solution to that, it's going to come through other means. But the problem is that this pivot can go in two directions in the United States. General Dempsey just went to China. This is extremely important. He also just went to Russia. General Dempsey is not only a very wise man, but he is literally the only thing that's standing in the way of the British Obama war plan in Syria, which could very well spark World War III against Russia and China, similarly with Iran. And it's because we have this historic American system tradition in our military, which luckily we have at our leadership right now in the form of General Dempsey and others around him. It was, in fact, on the Korea issue, Dempsey or one of Dempsey's spokesmen stepped in at the point of this wild provocation by the White House, held a press conference on background, so they didn't say who was speaking, but they were very clear. They said the White House dragged us into this series of provocations, which we recognize could in fact spark a miscalculation by the North and spark a war which would go way beyond Korea, and therefore we're stopping it. And we're not going to go by what they called the White House playbook, a good basketball term that I'm sure Obama cooked up in his while he was up there making up his kill list for the drone killings this week. So they basically pulled back. They announced they were not going to test an ICBM that was scheduled to be tested, and this was a clear sign to the North Koreans, and they pulled back. I think that's enough to be said there. The Japan issue was extremely important. We have a new government in Japan, Shinzo Abe, and, you know, there's a long, long history. Japan has been drawn in by the British to start two world wars. The modern Japan came about through an American system influence in the Meiji Restoration. It was through people that we mentioned before, Friedrich List, Henry Carey, that influence in Japan, which brought about the doing away with the feudal system and the launching of what became the modern industrialized agricultural state of Japan. But the British moved in the 1890s and basically said, look, you're an island nation like us. You have industry now, but you don't have raw materials. And we've learned that as an island nation, you're going to have the military naval power to get those raw materials by any means necessary. And through a longer process, succeeded in getting the Japanese to become a militarist power, to go to war against both China and Russia, which was the British intention, to try especially to break Russia's efforts through building the Transcontinental Railroad to open up Asia overland, so it would be independent of the British rule of the sea, and that you begin to have overland trade, what LaRouche, of course, has called the New Silk Road or the
Eurasian land bridge,
yeah. But this was the intent of the British. They succeeded in getting the Japanese to carry out wars against China in the 1890s and then 1905 against the Russians, and were successful in those wars. Then you had the British move in a big way through Wall Street. It was through J.P. Morgan and his man Thomas Lamont that the Japanese, who became the lobbyist for Japan in the United States, arguing that China, which was a backward power, drugged up, not mentioning that they had drugged them up through the Opium Wars, and therefore China's incapable of developing this rich territory in Manchuria, the northern part of China, and the Japanese, who were brilliant and industrial, they could do a great job, so we should let them go in and take over, which they did. And this was Thomas Lamont and J.P. Morgan, just as at the same time they were supporting Mussolini in Italy. This is the same process, and essentially backing the rise to power of Hitler. They were also pushing Japan to become an imperial power, invade, take over northern China, and ultimately to wage war against China, which was the opening shot of World War II. So, you know, the earlier thing had led to World War I. This led to World War II. And the British and the British allies in the U.S. are trying to get Japan to do the same thing today. They're saying, look, let's stand up against China. China's trying to seize your little islands. China's using its new economic power to take over Asia. We have to stand up to them. We have to confront that. We have to form this new Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, which is a new free trade zone, explicitly aimed at stopping China's rise. And we have to have this pivot, rebalancing, which is effectively saying we're going to build up massive military forces along China's border, all the way from Australia through Singapore, the Philippines, Japan, Korea, and so forth. So is Japan going to go along with that? Well, it's possible, unfortunately. They also induced them to launch a big quantitative easing, although I think that's more complex because they were watching their own economy deteriorate because of the quantitative easing going on in Europe and the United States. So they're trying to stop the yen from going up and to bring it back down to help their exports. But that's the one side. The other side is that Japan has this historic tradition from the Meiji Restoration and from the post-war period where MacArthur was the governor. He brought about a Glass-Steagall Bill in Japan. He encouraged a pluralist approach to politics where even the Communist Party that MacArthur opposed strongly was allowed to function, and basically built a pluralistic society, but one based upon this idea of directed credit, of a creditary system, rebuilding the economy, the opposite of what was being done to a certain extent to Germany, where they were using the Morgenthau Plan, you know, and basically saying Germany should not be allowed to reindustrialize. MacArthur never made that mistake. So Japan rebuilt. They have this tradition of the American system from long ago and more recently. And this is also a major impulse in that country. And they were destroyed by that earthquake, by that tsunami.
Yeah.
And the previous government, which was the Democratic Party, was a green party. They responded to the Fukushima accident by shutting down the entire nuclear industry, an absolute disaster, for no purpose. There was nobody killed in that nuclear accident, zero. There were thousands killed by the tsunami.
Yeah.
But nobody was killed by the nuclear accident. It was a bad accident, and you don't want to see that happen again. But the idea that this was the catastrophe is ridiculous. It was the tsunami that was the catastrophe. And nothing was done to rebuild northern Honshu. And Abe is committed to reopening the nuclear plants. He's committed to building up where it was destroyed. And in fact, while he's being brought into a certain confrontation with China, he at the same time very strongly recognizes that Japan's economic relations with China are very, very different from at the beginning of the 20th century when China was a backward country. It's crucial for Japan, it's crucial for China that they have good relations, that they work together in particular on building up the Far East of Russia. And Abe went to Moscow last month, and they talked about a number of projects, building a bridge between the Sakhalin Island and Russia, which is to the north of Japan, developing some of the oil and gas resources in Siberia and the Russian Far East. This is the kind of collaboration between Japan, Korea, China, and Russia, which could be, in the words of Pope John Paul II, or no, I'm sorry, Paul VI, Pope John VI, who said in the Populorum Progressio that the new name for peace is development. This idea that you have to have development first and then you can establish a basis for solving the political problems. So not only between those great nations, but also solving things like the North Korea problem. You have to have this kind of development process. So it's a question of the American system versus the British system, as it is everywhere in the world. And it is they're heading in the right direction on that, but it won't work if we don't get Glass-Steagall and get the United States out of its current British mode of hyperinflationary money printing and undermining the crucial productive capacity in the United States and the import capacity of this country. Which is in fact very crucial for the rest of the world, this kind of integration. So that's pretty much where we stand. It's what direction's Asia going to go? Well, it's largely going to be defined by what happens here in the next few weeks and the next few months as to whether or not we can, in fact, have Asia be a major, major input to a new global renaissance and a new global development, or if they are going to be driven into a new series of wars by the people around the British and Obama who are committed to that war policy.
Yeah, I'll point out, I hope people saw on EIR Online a report on the last conference that you attended, the one in Germany, where a gentleman from Japan, Mr. Kotagawa, was very strong in his language that there's nothing else but to put in a Glass-Steagall Act. He spoke about Europe, so that these speculative gambling houses, he said, be liquidated as soon as possible to save Europe. It's a war against filthy bankers who gained a lot of money from gambling and let taxpayers pay for their bosses. So when you say there are two ways for Japan, this one couldn't be more outspoken.
Yep. He's a very unusual, outspoken Japanese, and not just an interesting person, but the person who was head of the division at the Ministry of Finance in the 1990s, who was responsible for unwinding the Japanese banks that were going through their crisis in
of
the
90s. Real estate bubble. And
he always makes the point, he says, you know, we made it through by the skin of our teeth, but partially it's because we forced these banks to unwind their bad debt, and we threw a lot of them in jail. And in the West, they have done none of that. Oh. They have basically just continued the gambling process, thrown nobody in jail. In fact, they left the same people there to continue building up the same derivative bubble, which is now bigger than it was in 2007. So he knows what he's talking about. And he's I think he represents precisely the better direction in Japan, which is why he's looking so much towards Lyndon LaRouche, whom he admires very, very greatly.
Well,
and is sending a letter, by the way, in addition to the speech you just read, he's sending a letter directly to the members of the House and the Senate saying, we in Japan call on you to implement Glass-Steagall now. This is crucial for our survival as well as yours.
Right. And some people in public life, like this, I mean, you know this gentleman, I don't know, but the stand back again. Of course, everyone listening here may know that Tom Harkin is a Democrat. His other senator from Iowa is a Republican, Senator Grassley, and he'll have to figure out what he's going to do. He's on the he's on the Judiciary Committee, which very much is challenged by all the lawlessness of the Obama administration and confronted with grounds for impeachment in many ways. But Tom Harkin has been, he is one of the senior Democrats. He's been around a long time, and Iowa is a well-known state. And so the significance in terms of potential for people around the world to continue to both pressure and provide support that the United States, that we have to force this action in Washington. We can do it. It can be done. I just think it's this signifies it. And let me just say, in the closing minutes, we didn't at all, Mike, get time in this program, but something was dear to your heart. I mentioned that you had been wrongfully jailed along with Mr. LaRouche and other people in this witch hunt railroading operation. Part of the British deployment here and abroad to prevent development for humanity. But during that time, you wrote a wonderful piece about Asia on the Confucian Renaissance, the 1100s, I guess, the 12th century in China. That's still available. I want to tell people, or not still, it's been available all along, but it's on the Schiller Institute website. Is the easiest to find. You can do that. I think it's schillerinstitute.org. Look for Mike Billington, look for Confucius.
And one of the speakers at the last Frankfurt conference in April was a Mr. Cui, who spoke on the revival of Confucianism in China. And we had a long discussion, and he made a very strong presentation about the absolute importance to the world that China is returning to its Confucian roots from its, basically, you might say, atheistic or anarchistic thinking that dominated during the Cultural Revolution. So I think I would like to make sure that we are part of that Renaissance, Confucian Renaissance movement going on in China today.
Oh, that's very good. And Mike, I think we, well, I'll mention here in June, there's a Pacific conference that happens to be in San Francisco in the New Paradigm series, right? Do you want to say June 29?
29, right.
And right now, there is a conference in Australia. I mean, literally today, the 17th, 18th, and 19th, this is for a nobler outlook of mankind. And we, unless there's some radical change, we have, I'm glad to say, made arrangements for one of the leaders of the Citizens Electoral Council in Australia, a woman named Jean Robinson, who lives in the state of Western Australia. It's about half of Australia. It's out there near Perth. She's a wheat grower, and she may join us next week for the LaRouche Show, if we can arrange the logistics. But I think we have our work cut out for us here in the United States, and we could go into many other updates. It's the fact that two more state legislatures had texts, resolutions memorializing Congress to act. It was Illinois, it was Delaware. So this is now our way of life. There isn't anything but to work on this. And I guess, Mike, that brings us to a close for today, May 18th, 2013. Thanks, Mike Billington.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, and I'll sign off. Thank you very much. This is the LaRouche Show.